Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. My co-host tonight, Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst Dean Johnson. Our topic tonight, political polarization, tribalism. Every day it feels more and more like our country comprises two cultures. Our divisions run so deep that people have begun to ask, are we still, as the Pledge of Allegiance says, one nation? So tonight we ask questions that we once thought were of as being on the fringe of political debate, but that now have become more mainstream. How did we get here? Are the blue states and the red states heading towards a breakup? And as always, the key question, what should we do about it? Dean?
Good evening, everyone. Now, tonight, as Jeff said, we talk about the elephant in the room, whether the issue is the right to choose versus the right to life, the Second Amendment versus gun control, closed borders and who gets to patrol them versus sanctuary cities, the peaceful transition power or the January 6th insurrection, evangelicism versus secularism, or free markets versus democratic socialism. It feels like people in the red states and people in the blue states are living in alternate realities. Some of the measures passed in response to the Supreme Court's recent abortion decision actually prohibit state employees from cooperating with courts and law enforcement in other states and potentially conflict with provisions of the United States Constitution. And serious scholars have begun to ask, will officials and ordinary citizens like us openly defy state and federal law? Are we still one nation? Should the red and blue states go their separate ways? So as always, we have questions for you tonight, listeners. Have we reached the point of no return? Should, would, could our nation split in two? And if California or the West Coast or the blue states attempt to secede from the Union, would you go along with it? Jeffrey?
We want to hear your take. This is a very controversial topic. We want to hear from you. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Please bear in mind our guests are here to educate and inform you about the issues of the day. They're not here to provide you legal advice on particular cases. They haven't seen everything you got. And the opinions expressed on the show tonight are not necessarily those of KALW or NPR, the Bar Association of San Francisco, or any of our guests or their employers. But we want to get you in on the conversation. It is highly topical stuff. And again, our number is 866-798-8255. Dean?
Tonight, we are very pleased and excited to have as our guest David French. David is the author of a fascinating book called Divided We Fall, The Secession Threat and How to Restore Our Nation. And just as a personal note, this book is a must-read for any of you who are concerned about where America is and where it might be going. It presents a graphic description of America's two cultures and the fault lines between them, and two frighteningly realistic scenarios of how America may come apart. And it also has some very deep and thoughtful reflection on how our nation might be restored. By way of background, David is currently a senior editor of The Dispatch, a conservative online news service. He has previously written for The National Review and The Atlantic, among other publications. David graduated cum laude from Harvard Law School. He served a tour of duty in Iraq as a major in the United States Army and was awarded the Bronze Star. David briefly considered a run for president in 2016, citing his moral objections to the candidacy of the presumptive Republican nominee, one Donald Trump. He and his family subsequently came under attack from the right, being bombarded by hateful tweets and other messages, including, tragically, an image of his daughter in a gas chamber. David calls himself and considers himself a Christian and a conservative, and although a lifelong Republican, he now calls himself a man without a party. David, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor.
Well, you know, I'd like to get the conversation started, and I've got to say, I join with Jeff. I can't believe that we are having a serious conversation on the air about the possible breakup of our union. But the story of how you came to write a book on the secession threat, the possibility right. that states might withdraw from the union, it's a very personal one, isn't it? And yeah. ironically, it started with your tour of duty in Iraq. Could you tell us about that story?
Yeah, absolutely. I joined later in life. I was an old guy in officer basic training, made it through and went to Iraq at the height of the surge during 2007 is when I got there and was there in 2007 and 2008. And we were in Diyala province, which is eastern Iraq, right near the Iranian border, right in the fault line between Sunni and Shia. And so I heard from both Sunni and Shia Iraqis about why they fought each other. And what really struck me when they were describing why they fought, it wasn't because of differences between allocation of oil revenues, as serious as that is as a matter of policy in Iraq. It wasn't even about the composition of the army and the military. I mean, the army and the police force, as serious as that was. It wasn't about theological differences. Both sides, what was animating the fight is that both sides had a tale of grievance about the other. The Shiites killed my cousin, or the Sunni killed my uncle. And that story of mutual grievance, and these were real grievances. These are things that actually happened, atrocities that actually happened, were the jet fuel for this civil conflict. And when I came home in 2008, I unmistakably saw many of the same patterns, not the same intensity. So in other words, the grievances that red had against blue and blue had against red were not of the same gravity. We weren't seeing the level of political violence, for example, that you had in Iraq, obviously, thankfully. But what you had was an emotional response to people on the other side that was many times rooted in very real things that had happened that were infuriating, enraging, offensive, you name it. And each side had a story about the other side. And that's what really struck me. And then as I began to dig more into what was happening, I noticed a couple of things. One is that a lot of our division is not just intellectual, it's very emotional. There's a lot of raw animosity in the United States of America. And then the other thing is, if you think about the important trends in American life, whether they're religious or social or cultural or political, none of them are pulling us together as much as they push us apart. And my basic thesis is this just can't keep going on indefinitely without us hitting a fault line.
You know, one of the things that struck me, you have a very graphic image in the book. You say if you take the divisions in America and you take the economic divisions, the class divisions, the ethnic divisions, the religious and political divisions, and you map them out, and you mm-hmm. lay the maps on top of one another, that those divisions would all coincide. Everybody right. is on one side of the line or the other, much like what you saw in Iraq. How does that happen?
Well, you know, there's this phenomenon that's been going on for a long time, and I'm going to use a term coined by Bill Bishop in a book many years ago called The Big Sort. And what is happening is that people are moving and living in areas, increasingly moving to and living in areas where they share they're living with people of like mind. And in other words, the number of counties, for example, that are called landslide counties, those are the counties, you know, the Bay Area is a landslide region. I live in a landslide county in the opposite direction, that the number of counties that are landslide counties is reaching every 4 years a new high, so that people are living increasingly around others of like mind. And then what that does is when you live around people of like mind, the common expression of your common political expression tends to become more extreme. This is a phenomenon from Cass Sunstein called the law of group polarization. And that means when people of like mind gather, they tend to become more extreme. And so what's happening is we're in a cycle where people are living with people who agree with each other, and we're becoming more extreme almost without even realizing it as a consequence. And as each side becomes more extreme, they run further apart from each other. And you can see this in the social science data. It used to be that American politics was this big bell curve where you had the radicals on either end, but then the big middle of America was, you know, that was the bulk of the American population. But now that's beginning to flatten out and turn into sort of a mild U instead of a bell curve. So there's many more people clustered on these ends than there ever used to be. And that's one consequence of this big sort and group polarization.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about that on the radio a couple of times. I've mentioned what used to be called the median voter theorem, which says that, yeah, you know, most of those voters in America are gathered there in that moderate middle, slightly to the left, slightly to the right. But the winner in most political contests in the United States would be the person who managed to grab onto that middle. And now it sounds like, from what you're saying, it sounds like the middle is sagging. The numbers are moving out of the middle and toward the extremes.
Yes, yes, exactly. So that doesn't mean that there isn't where you do see sort of a bell curve is in political engagement. There's only a few people relative to the size of the population who are really fully engaged politically. And you have a big group that is not all that engaged, but they're right, left, middle. That lack of engagement doesn't mean they're moderates. It just means they're not fully engaged into politics. But the political and ideological polarization of this country is very, very real. And we've been able to map this out for 25, 30 years so that people are further apart than they've been in a very long time. And then here's the thing that makes it all worse. We're further apart than we've been, but at the same time, we believe we're further apart than we are. And so we have this mass scale because we don't tend to live or work as much around people who disagree with us. We have a mass scale misconception about each other. So your typical Republican tends to think your typical Democrat is more extreme than he or she really is, and vice versa. The typical Democrat tends to think their typical Republican is more extreme than he or she actually is. And if you ask Republicans about Democrats, you almost often get hilariously wrong answers about who Democrats are. And if you ask a lot of Democrats about Republicans, you often get hilariously wrong answers about who Republicans are. And that's a consequence of this separation.
Yeah, I know. We've talked about that on the show as well. I think everybody who's listening knows that I have family back in North Carolina who, if you look in the dictionary under Donald Trump base, their picture is next to it.
Right.
They're evangelical, they're Christian, they're Republican, mm-hmm. they're very conservative. They always vote a Republican. They live in a red state. And then the common theme I get from them is, gee, I don't know how Joe Biden got elected. Everybody I know voted for Trump. And the images you get really don't conform to the reality. They will post things on Facebook saying that Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic elite is out to destroy America. And then I point out, look, I'm to the left, but I don't fit those stereotypes. I own guns. Yeah. I teach gun safety classes. I believe in nuclear power and other sources other than wind and solar. I disagree with some of my liberal friends, but that's true. The stereotypes are extreme. And I wonder, how is this becoming so extreme? Is this the product of media and the fact that we're all in echo chambers and silos and we each choose our media to reflect what we expect to hear?
Well, that's actually a big part of this, because the research shows, and this is kind of funny, the more media you consume, the more political media, I put that out, the more political media you consume, the more wrong you often are about your political opponents. So those people who consume the least amount of political media tend to be the most correct about what the other side believes. And that's because they get their view of what the other side believes from these things called friendships and relationships. Whereas if you're learning about the other side entirely through political media, you're often getting what you're getting a skewed view. You're getting the view that is reinforcing and reaffirming your priors. And then when you combine that with living and working with people of like mind, everything is feeding into a particular narrative. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't extremists out there. That doesn't mean that there aren't radicals out there. But to say that there are extremists in the GOP, for example, is not to say that the GOP at writ large is as extreme as you think it is. Although in many areas, we just had a primary election yesterday in Arizona where the winners were quite extreme. So I don't want to sugarcoat things here. But consistently, the data shows that people have mistaken views of their political opponents.
You know, as somebody who lives relatively close to the center, and I have friends that tend to be farther left, farther right.
Right.
And what I'm finding is some remarkably parallel streaks in their dialogue. Each one tells me that they see the other as trying to create a one-party state.
Yeah.
And the fear that lives in each side when they view the other, very similar.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. You're going to hear a lot of the same fears expressed when you are talking to someone who's very, very Republican, just as you will if you're talking to someone who's very much on the left. Now, what's interesting is, though, there's some distinctions here, because if you're going to talk about one of the big fears of the left, it is minority rule. In other words, that there is a, through the quirks of the Electoral College, through the quirks of the system of the U.S. Senate, that Republicans can gain the upper hand without ever winning voting majorities. And so, you know, for example, Republicans have won exactly one popular vote since 1988 in the presidential election, and that was George W. Bush very narrowly in 2004. Yet they've won three presidential elections, and two of the three they won without a popular vote majority. And Trump almost won again in 2024, despite losing the popular vote by 7 million. And there's the Senate, the disparities in the Senate mean that about 70% of the Senate within just a few years' time is going to be selected by less than 30% of the population, or around 30% of the population. So that is, you hear a lot of fear on the left of minority rule. On the right, you have a lot of fear of majoritarian tyranny. In other words, that there's going to be that an emerging leftist cultural and political hegemony is going to sweep away the fundamental rights of people in red America. And so they both have a catastrophic view of the future, but they're subtly different. They're rooted in slightly different fears.
One of the other things I hear from my more conservative friends is this tremendous fear that the next generation coming up are somehow all socialist, and that their entire way of life is going to disappear. Just as my friends on the farther to the left have this great fear that the right wants to completely disenfranchise them and make it so they can't vote or they're liable to be thrown in jail.
Yeah, it's funny though on the generational concern. I'm old enough now. I'm 53, where I've seen now a couple of generations of fear expressed about the younger generation from conservatives. That seems to be sort of a perennial concern, that the new generation is going to rise and supplant the old generation, and it's going to be more liberal or progressive, or and it never really seems to quite materialize like that. But yes, I have heard that same thing. I've also heard the exact same thing. And especially after what happened on January 6th and the effort to steal the presidential election, let's just call it what it was, an effort to steal our presidential election. It was an insurrection on January 6th that, you know, that there are folks on the right who just will not believe an election result that is, they will not believe they actually lost.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden with tonight's co-host, Dean Johnson. We're tonight discussing whether it's the political polarization or even a blue state rebellion. Our guest is David French, nationally recognized columnist and author of Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat, and How to Restore Our Nation. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. This is a really a really interesting topic that's very controversial, and we would love to have your thoughts. Call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You don't have to jump in exactly where we are in our conversation. We want to hear from you. Anything on tonight's topic. You want to jump in? You want to be a part of a different nation? Call us toll-free, 866-798-8255.
Yeah, so David, continuing the conversation, I mean, let's just get a couple of questions out of the way. You're talking to us from a red state. Mm-hmm. You consider yourself a Christian and a conservative. I have to assume, and maybe I'm wrong, I have to assume that you think that the Supreme Court was correct in overturning Roe versus Wade.
Yes.
By the way, do you agree with the reasoning, or are you just happy with the outcome?
I largely agree with the reasoning. It really, not to get too far into the weeds here, but this is a legal show, so we can get into the weeds.
Absolutely.
Since abortion is obviously not an enumerated right in the Constitution, it dives into the existence of abortion as a right. It becomes a question of would it be an unenumerated right? In other words, The Constitution quite plainly and explicitly protects rights that are not specifically enumerated. It does so in the Bill of Rights. It does so by implication and explicitly in the 14th Amendment. And so the question then becomes, is abortion a right that is an unenumerated constitutional right? And I think Scalia got it quite right, especially from an originalist perspective, that no, the 14th Amendment was not intended to. The 14th Amendment was not intended to protect an abortion right.
All right, let me just follow up on that. So I would take it also, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, and I don't want to stereotype, but I would take it also that you agree with Justice Thomas that given there are other unenumerated rights like the right to same-sex marriage, the right to contraceptives, and so on, that you would kind of agree with Justice Thomas that maybe those ought to be reexamined.
No, not really. So I agree with what Alito said in Dobbs, which was that abortion is different from those cases. And Alito said that abortion is different from those cases because it involves another life. The potential life of the unborn child is the words used by in the Roe court, or the unborn child, or the words used in the Mississippi law. So whereas the contraception case or same-sex marriage or, Lawrence v. Texas involving adult sexual intimacy, all of those cases involve individuals they involve consenting adults. Well, when it comes to abortion, what you have is an impact on a person, the child, who is absolutely not consenting to this procedure. And it's a different framework in a different analysis than when you're talking about something like marriage. Yeah.
Well, you did once join in a statement saying that same-sex marriage was a sin, right?
Yeah, well, there's a difference between saying something is against your religious beliefs and saying that it should be unlawful. Those are different analyses.
Thank you for that. And I think we have now lit up the call boards.
That we have. And as Ronald Reagan once said, funny how all these folks that are speaking in favor of abortion have already been born. Let me turn it over to Mohan in Menlo Park. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Yeah, really enjoyed the show, particularly the insightful comments of your guests here. One of the questions I had is, we tend to think of things on a spectrum. You know, we draw a line and we think about right and left. Is the guest kind of suggesting it's a circle, that somehow they kind of meet together? It's really like when you get the extreme, they actually are closer apart than they're further apart?
That's a great observation, actually. And there's actually a theory called horseshoe theory. And horseshoe theory says that when two political parties, as they grow more extreme, they grow closer to each other. And what is, you will see this in the United States of America, and that the more extreme a person becomes within the American system, what we are seeing is the more likely they are to become illiberal. In other words, to reject the classical liberal principles of the founding and to seek to suppress the civil liberties and freedoms of their political opponents. And so that's a hallmark of extremism in our current system, is that those who are most extreme tend to be have a quite similar outlook to their political opponents about things like the First Amendment, for example, and would be quite willing to suppress the free speech rights of their political opponents. And that's horseshoe theory in action, where extremes, as they grow more extreme, they start to loop back and begin to mimic each other, both in behavior and outlook.
Great question. Thanks.
Mohan, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. I think that was a very outstanding question. And I think we've seen this all play out in Central America 40 years ago, and we're heading down that road ourselves. Jody from El Cerrito, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
Hey,
you're
Jody.
On the air.
I've been thinking a lot about the title of a book that I read years ago called The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism. And I like democratic socialism and democratic capitalism. And I wish we could hear more about democratic capitalism. We hear a lot about democratic socialism, but democratic capitalism is quite a good thing, I think. That's all I have to say.
David?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting observation. One of the things that I'm often intrigued by is, how do we define our terms? You know, when I have democratic socialist friends who would say the society that they are wanting America to move closer to is more like, say, a Denmark or a Norway, some of the Scandinavian social democracies that are still quite capitalistic. Truth be told, there's still a lot of capitalism in those countries and a lot of entrepreneurialism. There's also just a different conception of the provision of healthcare and a social safety net. So I think we often get really sloppy with our terms. And what might be a social safety net is called socialism, when that's not exactly the same thing. So I'm often very eager to get people to sort of move away from the labels and explain, what are the actual policies that you want to enact in accordance with this sort of, you know, in furtherance of this political ideology? And what you often find is there's not actually that many true socialists in the political conversation. I bet you have more in the Bay Area than we do here in the middle of Tennessee, but there's not that many true socialists in the conversation in the United States.
One of the sad realities is that the world seems to be moving away from the view that Jody just espoused. It seems that much of the world is heading towards perhaps relaxing the democratic side, but maintaining the private ownership. Totalitarian capitalism, as is emerging in China.
Right.
Really, a criminal government has set up in the former Soviet Union and Russia anyway.
You're exactly right. And you know, the China example is one where, you know, there was a lot of smart folks who said, you know, with economic liberalism will come political liberalism. And we now know that's not the case, that economic liberalism does not mean, in other words, increased capitalism does not necessarily lead to increased political liberalism, that China has become quite capitalistic and quite totalitarian at the same time.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Hey, I'm Jill Deacon, sitting in for Tom Power. The magician Penn Jillette says that honesty is just as important as mastering any sleight of hand. He'll explain why he's upfront about his tricks and how it's made him actually a better magician. That's coming up on Cue from PRX.
That's Q from the CBC, and now we'll be in the 7 o'clock hour here on 91.7 FM KALW. Local public radio server in the San Francisco Greater Bay Area and online at KALW.org. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's law referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. Now we return to Your Legal Rights with Jeff Hayden and Dean. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden with tonight's co-host, Dean Johnson. Tonight we're talking about whether it's political polarization or even a blue state rebellion. Our guest tonight is David French, nationally recognized columnist and author of Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat, and How to Restore Our Nation. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Either way, call us. We want to bring you in on the conversation. You don't have to jump in the exact point we may be. Controversial topic, we'd like to hear from you. And again, that number is 866-798-8255. Dean?
So, David, you know, we've been sort of dancing around the elephant in the room here. The book is about secession. It's about an actual breakup of the American Republic. And in your book, you have two scenarios, one called Cal Exit and one called Texit. And I've got to say, for our listeners, both of these scenarios read like movie scripts. I would go to either of these movies. but tell us very briefly, how does the country break up? What happens?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I looked at was we've had two previous secessions in American history. 1776, we seceded from the British Empire. 1861, the Confederacy seceded from the Union. And both of those secessions had something in common, or multiple factors in common. And I list them in the book. And these are also factors that you see in breakaway movements across the world. So think about how Scotland had a vote recently to whether or not to leave the United Kingdom. And it was not, it was closer, too close for comfort, I would say, if I was in favor of the United Kingdom remaining united. And Quebec has had votes, for example. And here's some factors that I think. So number one, do you have a large geographically contiguous region? In other words, a nation state sized region. Is it culturally homogenous? Does it have sort of a common language, a common culture, a common faith, a distinct way of life? Does it believe that that distinct way of life is under threat from an external force? And then is there a fear? And this is a very important factor for in 1776. This was a factor in 1861. Is there a fear of violence, of that divisions will go beyond political and in elections and voting and arguments on cable news and into the streets, into actual fighting, actual violence? And each one of these factors was at work in 1776, in 1861. The South whipped itself into a frenzy of fear after John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. One of the best single volume works about the Civil War is McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom, just a phenomenal book. And he talks about how the Confederate or the then Southern press whipped the Southern population into an unreasoning fury. If you read the secession documents, which state clearly that the South was seceding because of slavery and to protect slavery, you'll see constantly in those and in many of those documents references to fears that the North is stoking slave rebellions, The Texas secession document actually contains a conspiracy theory that the North was poisoning water supplies.
Wait, hold on, David. Are you saying that Fox News didn't invent that stuff?
No.
Oh, it's been
around. The media didn't get terrible just 25 years ago. There has been terrible media for a very long time. And so if you have nation state sized entities that feel as if they have a common way of life that's under threat and then begin to fear violence, that's a recipe for instability. And when I wrote the book, I'll be completely honest with you, I was nervous about putting the S word, secession, in the title of the book. I was nervous about the scenarios because I thought, people will think I'm losing my mind. That's not going to happen. I finished the book in 2020, and then in January 6th happens. And January 6th is something that I had this pessimistic view over the medium to long term that I wrote this book. But I wasn't even pessimistic enough to imagine storming the Capitol just a few months after it came out. And so it illustrates how events can spiral out of control. And for those who think that January 6th, if any listeners think that January 6th was not extraordinarily dangerous to the United States of America, I have just one question to ask. What if Mike Pence had said yes? What if Mike Pence had said yes to the John Eastman scheme and the memos and either declared Donald Trump the winner of the election, as the memos urged, or punted delayed the certification, stopped the certification of the election? If you start to go down, if your mind can go down the logical next steps, if Mike Pence had said yes, we would have faced the worst constitutional crisis since 1861. In last year, we would have faced that last year. And so suddenly I was less nervous about the thesis of my book and was much more confident in saying, look, these forces that we're unleashing on the United States of America could create a crisis point at the next election. I mean, let's put it this way. I'm 99% sure that the United States will survive the 2024 election. But for the first time in my entire life, I'm not 100% sure that we will survive the next election, especially if Donald Trump is the Republican nominee.
Yeah, and yet I've had this conversation with my red state friends and relatives that January 6th never really happened. It was just another pleasant day in Washington, and tourists were going about the Capitol as they always do. And, of course, there were some people who died, but, hey, they would have died anyway. They had heart attacks. They had health problems. I mean, how do we get that divided on the incorrigible facts?
Dean, we've heard members of Congress say exactly that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we are a product of what we – now, I draw a distinction between leaders. Members of Congress who say it, there is no excuse. You were there. You had to run for your life to minimize what happened on January 6th. That is an act of actual malice. But there are millions of Americans who consume right-wing media – who've never seen some of the worst footage of January 6th. They've never seen it. It has never crossed their social media feeds. It has never been on their television. If you mention the John Eastman memos, they have no idea what you're talking about. If you mention the fake elector scheme, they have no idea what you're talking about. Donald Trump's taped phone call in Georgia, they have no idea what you're talking about. And why do they not? Because they're consuming media that is not talking about this. And so one of the things that I said in The Atlantic on the onset of the January 6th hearings was all these right-wing blue checkmark people on Twitter were saying, oh, nothing new is going to – we'll see nothing new. Everybody knows this stuff. And I'm like, no, I live in an 85% Republican neighborhood. I know that people don't know this stuff. I know they don't know these facts. In every single hearing, at least some people have learned something they didn't know before.
Let me turn it to Matt from Richmond. Matt, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, well, thank you, Jeff. Well, I have a few things that I would like to say to your guest. I think he's seriously mistaken on a number of issues. First off, on the issue of the abortion decision, the 14th Amendment doesn't create any unenumerated rights at all. The first section and the privileges in the Privileges and Immunities Clause, all that does is get you to the first 10 amendments, what we typically call the Bill of Rights. And there's only one part of the Bill of Rights, one amendment in the Bill of Rights that has anything to do with unenumerated rights, and that is, of course, the Ninth Amendment. Only the Ninth Amendment deals with unenumerated rights. The 14th Amendment simply gets you to the Ninth Amendment in that it says that the first 10 amendments are now to be applied against the states as well as against the United States.
Hey, Matt, you know, I don't want to get into the, this is Dean, I don't want to get into the merits of constitutional law so much tonight. We've had that discussion before, but let me ask you something. The topic tonight is blue state rebellion and secession. If, say, Gavin Newsom comes on TV tomorrow night and says, you know, we've had it, we're backing out of the United States, you're going to go along with him or not?
No.
Why not?
Because in 1787 and 1788, we created a nation. California is a part of the nation. We settled the issue of secession definitively in April of 1865. No secession. Once you're in for good.
Matt, before you go further, you're a pretty educated guy. I can hear from listening to you. So I'm going to ask you a pop quiz. What you just said about once you're in for good has one exception. Can you name it?
No, there aren't any exceptions that I'm aware of.
There is one.
Legally.
There is one.
Oh, really?
By
and
treaty.
What might that be?
By treaty with the Republic of Texas, as part of our jumping in to the war with Mexico, our treaty says that if they want to, they have a couple of options that nobody else has. One of them is that they can divide into five states if they wanted to. And the other is they are the only state that has the legal right to secede.
Oh, really? Well, how come that wasn't respected in 1865? Wasn't that eliminated by the Compromise of 1850?
I think there was a little thing called the Union Army that prevented it.
The Union Army, it was not a court case.
It wasn't argued in court, although today we might see 60 different cases filed in, you know, 65 different venues. Who knows?
But you did bring up a good question, and that is if Texas said, hey, that's all good for the rest of you, you're going to stay together after this war, that's fine, but we're not going to join you again. We're done. Would they have been able to? And I don't know that we really know the answer to that.
Well, I would agree as far as the legal principle goes, but politically it was settled in 1865 because they were not allowed to leave. But you want to go into the blue states, red states thing more. Let me go a little farther here. All this talk about the divisions in American society is nothing new. It's been going on since the first Anglo-Dutch settlers arrived in North America. The people who settled in Virginia, the Church of England types, had a very different outlook on life than the Puritans who settled in New England. And the society has been divided dramatically ever since then. What we're going through now is just the same old, same old. We've had many periods in American history like this.
Matt, you raise a great question. Let's turn to David. I mean, he has a point, you know, that we, you know, we've held it together. We kind of blew it at the Civil War and the Reconstruction, but after that, up to a few years ago, we seemed to have a fairly unified nation and a workable government. What happened? Where did we take a wrong turn here?
Well, number one.
No, hold on, Matt. I'm asking David.
Okay.
Yeah, so we've had a number of near misses. You know, if you go to the election of 1800, for example, that was a scary time in the early Republic. There was an actual secession convention called during the War of 1812. There was near secessions before 1861 that were averted by various compromises. The election of 1876 was an extraordinarily trying time. We've gone through, and the caller's exactly right, we have gone through waves of division in the past. The problem that I have is we cannot be complacent that since we've survived them in the past, that means that we will survive them in the future. And so 1860, you know, the outcome of the Civil War looks inevitable in hindsight, but there were multiple pivotal moments in the war that arguably had Longstreet moved faster on day two of Gettysburg? Could that have turned out differently? Where it was a close run thing, having a united country. And so my argument is, look, we cannot just assume that because things have been okay and we've come through a series of crises in the past, that we're going to be okay in coming through crises in the future. And one thing that I would say, for example, if you want to talk about crises in the United States, in 1968, we were averaging about 2 domestic terror bombings a day. I mean, that's how much political violence that we had. Most of them didn't kill anyone, thankfully. But we were averaging about 2 domestic bombings a day in that late 60s, early 70s era in certain spans of time. And take that environment and filter it through our current partisan polarization. That alone might crack us up, that level of violence. And the other thing that is different now, that was different from even 30 years ago or 40 years ago, is a point that I talked about earlier. The measurable amount of animosity that we have for each other. So 52% of Trump voters in a recent poll said that if the blue states leave, let them go. If 40% of Biden voters said in a recent poll, if the red states leave, let them go. There's even this phenomenon that some social scientists are calling lethal mass partisanship. And this is when you ask people, would it be bad if large numbers of your political opponents just died? And about 20% of Americans say, that's okay with me. Now, if you want to go with the glass half full analysis, well, then 80% of America doesn't want anyone to die. But 20% is an awful lot of people. And so what we have is rising animosity, intense clustering in geographic enclaves, and now we're beginning to see the increasing political violence. We're seeing not just political violence in the sense of outright, like on January 6th, there's some of the riots in 2020. We're also seeing threats of political violence escalating. So that is something that is deeply disturbing.
Matt, thanks for joining us on Your Legal Rights. I'm going to jump to Rob in Oakland. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes. So I think Scotland was mentioned earlier on the show, and then to build on perhaps a trend of secession movements, including Brexit and this sort of thing, I'm just wondering how much, and not to sound too conspiratorial, but how much social media and maybe like Vladimir Putin may be a factor in all of that.
That's a really good question. I mean, I used to be a little bit more a little less pessimistic about social media. I mean, we didn't have social media in the Civil War. We didn't have social media in 1914 and 1939. And we're perfectly capable of going to war with each other and tearing the world apart without social media. But there's no question at this point, just the data is overwhelming that social media, I wouldn't say it's causing our divides, but the way in which we use it is exacerbating our divides. The way a hacking cough can break a rib, it's like a symptom that makes the underlying disease worse. And so I think that especially, and it's not every social media platform. I don't think Reddit is tearing America apart. Pinterest is not tearing America apart, nor is Instagram. A lot of it really is funneling through, for example, Twitter. And Twitter, I think, is particularly toxic for a couple of reasons. One, it is the social media platform of the American leader community, whether you're talking political leaders, their staffs, journalism, the people who are in politics are on Twitter. And then Twitter itself is almost it's created in a lab for sort of the online version of the drive-by shooting. And so it's just constant sniping, constant anger, constant escalation of rhetoric. And that's where America's elite leader class spends all its social media time. And I think America has a Twitter problem.
And of course, the ability to study the different groups and divide up so that your tweets are targeted in a way that didn't exist before.
Okay, yeah. So spoiler alert for the audience, the two scenarios that you describe in your book, one begins with the overturning of Roe versus Wade, Right. The other begins with a Supreme Court decision overturning a restrictive gun rights law.
Yeah.
Both of those happened a couple of weeks ago within a space of 2 days. So are we on the downward spiral? Have we reached a point of no return?
Well, you know, the reason why I chose both of those issues is they're incredibly hot button topics. But it wasn't overturning Roe, or it wasn't the gun rights case itself that was the cause. It was the reaction to them. So one of the things that you see in civil strife and civil conflicts is that a nation that is about to fall apart can no longer really absorb normal political dispute the way it used to. And so I chose those two issues just because they're sort of front of mind, hot button issues that people are deeply emotionally invested in the outcome for lots of good reasons. But an election is another kind of issue that when the fabric of the nation is frayed, a normal event, a close election, can become an existential crisis. And it just so happens that, you know, right after I wrote the book, it wasn't an abortion decision, it wasn't a gun decision, it was a close election that created the conditions, a close election exploited by Donald Trump that created a potential crisis. And again, folks who minimize that whole Stop the Steal effort, I just ask them to walk their mind through, what if Mike Pence had said yes to Trump's scheme? What happens then? So what I want to caution people about is that the higher the temperature, and the more the increase of distrust and mistrust means that we can't even handle normal politics the way we used to.
Let's not also forget that some of the neighboring governors were getting together National Guards to actually come into Washington because the president was not bringing any force to back up the Capitol Police. Mike Pence might not have joined in. He may have ended up being killed. Before I turn it over to Karen, and this is a very serious topic, but we've also had a caller text in and mention that they're looking to see if Maine, Vermont, and Massachusetts is going to succeed and form new Sanders land. So some people do have a good sense of humor when it comes to this stuff. Let me turn it over to Karen from Albany. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I know you're not quite on this subject anymore, but I think it's important to realize that as far as abortion rights, that there are a couple of things at play. There's the viability of a fetus, and there's also the life of a woman, and basically a woman's right to have the decision about her own life and her own body. And while those two things are seemingly opposed, I think that it's very dangerous if we lose that ability. I just wanted to put that out there because I've worked a lot with birthing women and women's health, and it's just so important that we don't lose sight of that right for a woman to decide what to do with her own life. And yes, it is sad, but there is the viability issue of, you know, at what point a fetus is viable. And if you're going to go from conception, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And that's just on the physical level. I'm not even talking about the religious aspect, but we're trying to keep religion and politics separate, so it's gotten kind of muddied.
Karen, thank you for your comments. Let me ask you the question that we put to our listeners. There's been talk of a federal ban on abortion, which may materialize someday. If that happened, would you be prepared to defy federal law?
Personally, yes. And unfortunately, I think that if you've ever seen The Handmaid's Tale, it's very frightening that this is going to, you know, basically you're talking about forced pregnancy as opposed to abortion.
Yep.
You know, Karen, this show tends to be about legal issues. And one of the things that we all need to do is to sometimes take a step back. And as you pointed out, these are women's lives we're talking about. And sometimes the legal analysis or the political analysis really leaves us wanting for the fact that we're talking about things that are going to change, even endanger the lives of real people. Sometimes we have to remind ourselves of all that.
As we say at the close of the show, remember, they're your legal rights, but only if you stand up for them.
Right.
Well, Karen, we're about out of time, but thank you for joining us in your legal rights.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night, and thank you again for joining us. And I do want to turn back to David French. We have about 2 minutes or thereabouts for you to for any closing thoughts you have.
A two-minute filibuster. Fantastic. So, you know, I think that that's a great call to sort of end on, because one of the things that I think that we lawyers often do is, much like it, when a doctor is presented with a patient in critical condition, you go into clinical and mode and you go into analysis mode. And it's one way that separates you from the gravity of what you're experiencing. And I think a lot of us who are in politics or in law, we go into that analytical mode. And one of the things that I try to do when I'm talking about the divisions in the United States of America is, yeah, there's a lot of analysis that you know, I've cited a bunch of theories and social science research. But at the end of the day, what has made me alarmed about America isn't the dry research. It's the raw emotion. It's the raw emotion that I see in my neighborhood around me. It's the raw emotion that I see when I encounter people who are politically active across the country, both red and blue. And there's just this incredible sense of anger, urgency, and fear that, and again, I'm not somebody who thinks that, this is unprecedented. I think the fact that it is precedented, that America has almost torn itself apart multiple times, in many ways actually makes me more alarmed. What it says is that we've not grown past that. And the one thing that I would say is to end on, how do we get past this? How do we get past this? Well, I have a bunch of, in my book, I have a bunch of policy ideas, but no one will want to enact any policy ideas that get us past this until we can do something about the animosity between American citizens. Because when you have that much hate, you don't want to protect someone else's liberty. You don't want to, you're not as concerned about their flourishing and their families. And so what we have to do, even before we get to the policy solutions, is there has to be a warming, a softening of the heart towards our fellow citizens. And maybe one way that can begin is we have to understand that a lot of us are under mistaken impressions about our fellow citizens. We think they're more extreme than they are. We think they are evil when they are not. And it's time for a broadening of the horizons and sort of a rethink of a lot of our prior assumptions about the people who disagree with us.
You know, even Bill Morris, as simplistic as it sounds, commented, so much of the wealth in this country is centered in the blue states. And maybe the key to the whole thing is just to invite our friends from the red states into the party. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco Bay Area. Our guest tonight has been author David French, author of the book Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat and How to Restore Our Nation. Tonight's show was produced by Dean Johnson, and to that end, I give thanks to my co-host, Dean Johnson. Next week, we take a look at labor, long presumed to have passed. No, labor is now flexing its muscles, and we're going to take a look next week at the new labor law. A big thanks to David for joining us tonight. It's been a most enlightening conversation. And our thanks to all of you for listening in. And at the controls tonight, we have Damian D. Minor and Eric Jensen. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night. And remember to stand up for your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. You're listening to 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area and online at kalw.org.